So this is my office on a good day. Actually, it's been cleaned up since then. I don't recognize it anymore. But I love puzzles, as you know, and wanted to talk today about how you can use puzzles to do interesting mathematics and algorithms and computational complexity. So I'm going to introduce that. I'm guessing everyone was here Wednesday. Anyone not here on the first talk? Few people. All right, so this is for you. My interest in puzzles started when I was 6 years old, and my dad and I had this Eric and Dad puzzle company. Things have changed a little bit since then. I'm more of a mathematician, but I think a lot of mathematicians like puzzles because solving puzzles is just like solving a math problem, except usually with puzzles you know there's a solution, and with math problems you're never sure. But it has that same kind of feeling, and for this reason, many mathematicians like puzzles. There are few who don't because they think, oh, it's just more work. It's just the same thing. But this is from, this is from Prague. Very good. Wow. Good recognition. Or somewhere. I got it somewhere in the Czech Republic. But yeah. This is a fun hedgehog puzzle. It's you have to get that hedgehog outside the cage, and it can be done. It's actually, it's interesting to wonder how this puzzle was designed, but my guess is that they started with the solution, which is essentially a kind of screw motion, a twist and pull, and then you set all the lengths so that it fits. So I'm curious whether they did that mechanically or with a computer, or I'm not quite sure. But even once you have that idea, doing it is quite tricky, so I didn't really reveal much to you. Anyway, what excites me the most is making new math and algorithm problems out of puzzles, which are how to design puzzles within a particular genre, how to solve puzzles within a particular genre. Can you do it automatically? And I think this reveals a lot about why we as humans enjoy puzzles. So in particular, there's this complexity space. And let's see, how many people know what NP is? And how many people do not? Wow, okay, good. This will be easy. How many are unsure? Yes. All right. You don't really need to know what they are, but you should know intuitively what they are. So we have, this is a small picture of the complexity hierarchy, and these are the problems that are easy to solve. You can solve them in polynomial time, so with a fast algorithm. And these are problems that we're pretty sure you cannot solve quickly, although it's technically an open problem. So we've got NP, which are all the problems you could solve quickly if you could make really good guesses. And then you've got P-space, which are all the problems you could solve with a reasonable size brain, but spending tons and tons of time. So that's what we usually solve on computers, I guess, with lots of time. After that is exponential time, which are all the things you could solve with a really, really large amount of time. Those we know are hard, and these guys we're not quite sure. Anyway, for each class of puzzle you look at, you can try to characterize, can we solve it with a fast algorithm, or are they sort of way out here, as hard as any problem in NP or P-space, and those we call NP complete or P-space complete. And those are sort of negative results, saying that there's no good algorithms to solve these problems. But I think they're also positive results for the puzzle, because a lot of puzzles, I think humans like challenges. And so if you can prove that your problem is NP hard or worse, then you get the sense that that's why people like to solve it, because it's a hard thing to do. You can also use, any of these results are useful for puzzle design. Even if you have a quick algorithm to tell you, is this puzzle solvable, then you can experiment with designs, run the algorithm and say, is this a solvable puzzle, until you find one that is solvable, and then you say, okay, maybe this is a good one to try out. And these negative results give you suggestions of, here are some constructions you can build that are really hard for people for algorithms to solve, and therefore for humans to solve, if you believe humans are algorithms, as I do. Okay, but also it's just fun to do the mathematics here. That's the original motivation. And in fact, I will start with the very first puzzle that I analyzed. This is what got me started. It's a simple little puzzle, mostly a computer game. This is a Palm Pilot, if it gives you an idea of how old that is. And so you have, it's called Clickomania. You have a grid of squares with various colors. And a move is to select a group of at least two same-colored squares, so a connected component of this grid, and click on it, and then it disappears and things fall. So it's kind of like Tetris, except everything just falls vertically. And your goal is to get down to an empty board, like this example. So it's not always possible. If you have a checkerboard of black and white, you can't click on anything, because you can only click on groups of size at least two. So you want to know, can you solve a given puzzle? And so we worked at this. This is in my Waterloo days. And it turns out if your puzzle consists of only one row or one column, you can solve it in polynomial time. But pretty much otherwise, it's NP-hard. So I guess this should be NP-complete, in fact. I can get my pen out here. So that's the complexity. And for those who know what context-free grammars are, you can express the solvable one-dimensional puzzles as context-free grammars, which is kind of cool. We know that it's hard when you have two columns only and five colors, or when you have five columns and three colors, but we still don't know the complexity for two rows. I might guess this is easy, but I'm not sure. Or for two colors. That I'm less sure about. So if you want some unsolved problems to start thinking about, this is a while ago. I haven't looked at it for the last 11 years, but it could be neat to think about again. I'm going to go through lots of results relatively quickly so we get a flavor for different styles. Tetris is a game everyone likes to play. I mean, it's a video game, but really it's a one-player puzzle. You're trying to pack as many blocks as you can without dying, going off the top, and it turns out that's NP-complete. Here, the usual game, you don't know what's coming more than one step ahead, but to make it a what we call perfect information puzzle or game, I'm going to tell you up front all the pieces that are going to come. I'll tell you the sequence of pieces that are going to come through the duration of the game, and you want to know, can you survive given those pieces? These kinds of puzzles actually used to appear in Nintendo Magazine. Practice for Tetris, and it turns out that's a really hard problem to solve. This is a fun result for me personally because I became a Tetris master as a result. This is from the Harvard Tetris Society, and it's in honor of your intellectual contribution to the art of Tetris, we masters of the Harvard Tetris Society hereby confer the title of Tetris Master upon Eric D. Domain on the 16th day of the 12th month of the year 17 Anno Tetri, which is since the invention of Tetris. I didn't have to play a single game to win this award. It was great. There's actually a lot of open problems here, so I thought I'd highlight those. Our proof starts with a board that has stuff in it, and it'd be really nice to know if the board is initially empty, and I just give you the piece sequence, is it NP-complete? This is very tricky. This would be very tricky to prove because you have sort of almost no structure. It's very hard to force things from a sequence of pieces. But maybe you could prove it's hard. Or even cooler would be if you could solve it in polynomial time. There's a few versions. If you have a constant board size in one of the dimensions, in real Tetris, you have a constant board size and you could solve the whole thing in polynomial time. But if you just know the number of columns or number of rows is small, is it hard? Called what?
Dan Quayle Tetris.
Dan Quayle Tetris?
Yeah.
All right, I won't go there. let's see. Another two-player Tetris could be fun. So in two-player Tetris, when you clear more than one row, those rows get messed up on the other side. And so that game could conceivably be harder, piece space complete. I don't think anyone has really looked at that. I heard some noise about it at some point. And it would be interesting to say something about the non-perfect information game of Tetris where you're given pieces online, but that's probably a more probabilistic statement or something like that. All right. Let's move on to the Rubik's Cube. Rubik's Cube I want to spend a little bit more time on because this is a new result and it's exciting. Rubik's Cube is very old. Many people here know Rubik here. And it's a cool puzzle, beautiful design. It shook the world. Everyone knows it. It's like an icon for puzzles. Maybe the most popular puzzle ever. So it's natural to study it. A lot of people have worked on the problem of diameter, which is what is the hardest puzzle, or what is the hardest configuration of the Rubik's Cube? What is the largest number of moves you might need to solve a given puzzle? And for a long time, there's been this example, which is called Superflip, and it the best-known solution for Superflip was 20 moves. And those are the 20 moves. And it's got this nice sort of checkering pattern. And let's see, it was discovered here in 1995. The lower bound that actually requires 20 moves to solve. And then over the years, people have been improving the upper bound. And finally, last year, it's proved that 20 moves always suffice. From any configuration of the 3x3x3 Rubik's Cube, you can do it in 20 moves. And so that's the answer. The diameter of the Rubik's Cube graph of all configurations is exactly 20. And you can even plot how many things are 20 away from the solved configuration versus in the middle, and these values are not exactly known. But there's a lot of configurations in the 3x3 Rubik's Cube. So this is a big computational effort with thousands of computers and I don't know how many computer hours, but a lot. Cool. So that's 3x3x3. But as an algorithms person, we're always interested in scalability. 3x3x3 is constant size, so it takes constant time to solve. So it's not very interesting from an algorithmic perspective. We're interested in scaling up. And Rubik's Cube aficionados also scale up. The largest built so far is a 17x17x17 cube, which for the low price of $1,500, you too can own one. It's 3D printed. The largest I own is a 7x7x7. These are only $100 or so dollars. 12x12x12 is pushing it. This is the largest sort of easily commercially available. But you can go online right now, shapeways.com, and order the 17. So how many moves do you need? The diameter of this one is 20. What's the diameter of the 17x17x17? Maybe we just need to throw another million computer hours at it. I don't think we will ever know the answer to probably even a 4x4x4 cube. The 3x3x3 was already pushing it with 43 quintillion configurations. You have to look up the rules to know how many. There's 7 quadradecillion configurations for this guy and 282 tresvigintillion configurations for the 5x5x5. And of course, it's conceivable there's some magic algorithm that tells you the diameter without looking at all the configurations. And it's not known whether that problem is NP-hard or something, but I would conjecture that there's no easy way to find out the diameter of these graphs, and we will never know the answer, the exact diameter for 4x4x4, unless we... No, I think we will never know. That's, you heard it here first. Definitely for the 5x5x5, we'll never know. But I think 4x4x4 even. Anyway, so there's a general question of as the size of the cube grows, how does the diameter grow? Now, that's something we can tackle. And we have this theorem from a paper this year. This is with Anna and a student at my dad, and Sarah Eisenstadt, a student at MIT, and Andrew Winslow, a student at Tufts. It turns out the diameter of an n by n by n Rubik's Cube is up to a constant factor, so we don't know it exactly. Otherwise, I would have the exact numbers, but it's roughly n squared over log n. And this is interesting, I think, in particular because of the log n. So n squared, or say some constant times n squared, is the surface area of the cube. And so if you look at most algorithms for solving Rubik's Cubes, they use about n squared moves. Basically, you do a constant number of steps, and you fix one square, or a constant number of squares. Then you do a constant more steps, you fix another square, and another square. Usually, you spend at least one move per square on the surface. That would give you an n squared bound, but we can do a little bit better, divided by log n. So I wanted to show you how that works. In fact, it's very easy to show you need at least n squared over log n moves. So we proved this within the first hour of thinking about the problem. The harder part is to show that you can, it's enough to do n squared over log n moves. So I don't want to spend too much time on this proof, but the idea is You look at the number of configurations of an n by n by n Rubik's cube, there's about n squared bits of information in that configuration. Okay, pretty much every square can be sort of in one place or in the wrong place. That's an easy sort of lower bound n squared bits. On the other hand, if you look at how many different moves are there that I can make, well, I could turn this slab or 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 this one or this one. But really, there's only about n different ways to move the cube. There's about n moves, which means each move only encodes about log n bits of information. So you divide, you need at least n squared over log n bits just to get everywhere. Sorry, n squared over log n moves in order to be able to get everywhere. So if you know information theory, that will be obvious. Otherwise, believe me. It also holds for this kind of configuration, which we're going to look at a lot because it's easier to draw the pictures. This is an n by n by 1 Rubik's square, we're going to call it. It has various trade names for different sizes. So now let me tell you about the upper bound. How do we achieve n squared over log n moves? This is going to get a little bit more technical. So the idea is to, for every square, I'm going to think about the two-dimensional version. So you can flip one of these columns or rows. And if you look at one of the, and we're just looking at, say, the top and the bottom, say it's red and blue, so those are your two choices. If you look at the top here and one of these squares on the top side, where can it go? If you do all possible moves, it can go here, here, or here. In general, all the sort of reflections around the x and y axis. So if you look at an arbitrary sort of pixel, there's four different places it can go to. In the 3x3x3, it's the same thing, except it's 24 positions it can go to. It's just harder to draw, but it's some constant. So we call these clusters. These four pixels can interchange, but they can't go anywhere else, if you think of all the moves that are possible. So if you have n squared surface area, you're going to have n squared clusters. Each of them has a constant size, and each of them has a constant number of different configurations they could be in. Let's say the solved position is when everything is red on the top side, which we're drawing here. So this is solved, and this is sort of anti-solved. And for each of these configurations, there's some move sequence that will fix it. And in fact, it will fix the cluster without touching anything else. This is sort of how you normally solve Rubik's cubes. If you're here, you flip this column, V1, and then you flip this row, and then this column, and then this row, and you'll end up here. And you won't touch anything else. Turns out. So clusters are kind of key. You can fix individual clusters without touching the rest of the configuration. So this gives you an easy n squared algorithm, fix each cluster one at a time. But we want to do a little bit better. We want to exploit some parallelism. And the intuition is that when you do one operation, like you flip one row, conceivably that could be useful for many different clusters, not just one at a time. And so here's some formalization of this intuition. Suppose that we had, let's say, four pixels that are all in the same configuration. So each of these induces a cluster, which is like these four guys. So these are in this configuration that I was pointing at before. And we can solve all of them together a little bit more efficiently by following the same recipe. It says, I'll flip this first column, then the first row, then the first column, then the first row. But we do it for all of the relevant rows and columns. So we're going to flip the first column, which is this one, but we're going to do it for both of the guys in the group. So we flip those two, we get that picture. Then we flip the top rows, so that gives us this picture. Then we flip the left columns again, so those two guys end up with this picture, and then you flip the top two rows again. So we solve all four of these in, it's a little hard to count the number of moves here, but in general, if you have an x by y sort of submatrix of things in the same configuration, then you can solve it in basically x plus y moves. So that's cool. And we can use that to get to fix things by this log n factor. And here's where things get a little bit technical, so bear with me. There's a constant number of different pictures like this. So I'm just going to solve each of them separately. So let's focus on this one, which has the solution V1H1. And what we're going to do is we have a big n by n matrix. I'm again just looking at the two-dimensional version. I'm going to look at the first small number of rows. This is going to be like log n rows of this thing, but all columns of those rows. Now, each of these pixels, if you look at its cluster, all the places it could go, it's either in this configuration or not. And let's say yellow is this configuration and brown is everything else. So I'm just looking at which pixels are in the same configuration. I'd really like to find a submatrix of these guys that are all in the same configuration, but how do I do that? Well, when I have this sort of binary color coding of in the configuration I care about or not, and I have a whole bunch of columns and just a few rows, it's natural to distinguish which of these columns look the same. There aren't that many different patterns. If I have k rows here, the number of different binary patterns with k bits is 2 to the k. And so the number of different types of these little, calling them subcolumns, is only 2 to the k. And if I find a whole bunch of subcolumns of the same type, that's really giving me a submatrix. Here it's, I guess it's more impressive if brown was the good color. So if brown was the good color, then here I have a 2x3 submatrix, and I can solve all of those very quickly, very efficiently. So as long as I can find these big submatrices, I'm happy. And you just do the arithmetic at this point and it works out. That's the short version. They don't have to be in sequence. They don't have to be consecutive. Yes. They can be spread out. So that kind of submatrix, not the... So I should say here, the move to flip a row, we're thinking of just flipping that slab. So normally, that's a little weird in real life, but you could think of that as flipping the bottom half and then going down one row and flipping it back. So it's just that one. You don't need too many fingers to execute this move. It's just a factor of two, how you're counting the moves. Okay, anyway, if you find such a submatrix, it's going to be k, at most k tall, and it's going to be however many subcolumns of the same type you have wide, so that's your submatrix size. And so we know how to solve that in just k plus the number of different subcolumns. You add this up over all subcolumn types, and there's 2 to the k different types. So this k gets multiplied by 2 to the k. And this sums up to just the number of subcolumns, which is n. So you end up with this bound, and you plug in k equals 1/2 log n, and you get n squared over log n. So that's maybe not the most intuitive, but it works. Oh, yeah, I also had to multiply by n over k because this was just k of the rows. I had to do all of them. But within, basically, you were getting this log n factor improvement because there's, because there's these 2 to the k different patterns there. And that's optimal up to constant factors. Of course, I claim we will never know exactly what the diameter is for a 20 by 20 by 20 cube. And one reason for that is, this is some intuition for that claim, although it doesn't really prove it. We have one NP hardness result, which is if I have an n by one square, like this, and there's three colors in this pattern instead of just the usual two. Here's the color coding. There's red and blue as usual. Red is the desired face-up color and blue is the other one. But then I also allow white squares, or white clusters, which I don't care about. So I don't tell you whether they're currently solved or unsolved. You just don't have to worry about them. So this is actually a somewhat harder version of the puzzle. And in this case, the solving Rubik's Cube with the exact fewest number of moves is NP-hard. So this gives you some idea that finding the exact minimum number of moves from a given configuration is hard. But this is kind of cheating to have these squares we don't care about, and it's an open problem Because the real open problem is it NP hard with just red and blue, given some initial configuration? So that's Rubik's Cube. Any questions about that? Yeah. Yeah, you can think of it as like the parallelism that there's some situations where you can do better, but in all cases you can guarantee that a move sort of helps log n different clusters at the same time. Yeah, it's a bit bizarre. But. All right, let's move on. More cubes, but moving more towards folding puzzles. So this is a puzzle. The exact story of this puzzle is kind of funny. I think George Miller, who's a well-known puzzle designer, was talking about at a cocktail party or something, saying, oh, wouldn't it be cool if you could make some two-dimensional unfolding that would fold into all different tetracubes or all different arrangements of four cube little cubes joined together face-to-face. And Donald Knuth, famous computer scientist, was within earshot. And that night, he went back and implemented some code that enumerated all possibilities, and then he sent email to George Miller saying, I was thinking about the problem you posed, and here's all the solutions, and I really like this one, and together they chose this. There's a lot of solutions, and this is their favorite because it occupied a small amount of area, so it's easier to manufacture and sell. This is the commercialized version, and it's fun to play with. And so a natural question is, well, that's four cubes. Can you do it with five cubes? And the answer, this is a little harder to compute just because there's more configurations, but you can do it computationally. And it turns out the answer is no. So there's 24 different ways to arrange five cubes without any cycles. But you can get 23 out of 24 of them from this configuration. So if you want to manufacture a puzzle, this would be a good one to make. Then the puzzle would be, which can't you make, I guess? That would be quite tricky. There's lots of open problems here. Obviously, if it doesn't work for five, it's probably not going to work for six and seven, and it gets worse and worse. So you have a lot of different ways. It's not clear, actually, the asymptotics of that. How many can you get? Can you always get an exponential number? That's probably yes, but what constant, what base can you get? Let's see. There's an interesting question. There may be some polycubes, some arrangements of k cubes, such that there's no way even to unfold it at all. We don't know the answer to that question. Or in particular, a little easier is, are there two polycubes that have no common unfolding? There's no one structure that folds into both of them. All of these things are open, and this is sort of the sad state of unfolding that we don't know what exactly is possible. I talked about these folding puzzles on Wednesday, so I don't want to talk about them again, but the general spirit was take an open problem we're trying to solve, convert it into a puzzle. But this is the general spirit of folding puzzles. So here's a sort of origami-inspired problem slash puzzle. I give you some pattern of creases that I'm going to make on my square piece of paper. What does it fold into? What shape does it fold into? Any suggestions for this one? Maple leaf, that would be nice. No, it actually folds into a question mark. there's a magic trick based on this kind of crease pattern, actually. And this kind of puzzle is also NP-complete. So if I give you some crease pattern, and I want to know, even does it fold flat at all? Does it make anything in some sense? That, in general, is NP-complete. That's one of the first results in computational origami. And the proof looks something like this. But nonetheless, there are many special cases you can solve, and you can use this to design some fun puzzles. Like this, I claim, writes a message. And if you're really good, you can read the message. It's one word, but I, unless you're used to it, I think it's a little tricky. But the principle is just fold this, and the message will appear. So it's kind of like a way to hide your secret message. And this uses a theorem I talked about on Wednesday, that you can fold any orthogonal maze, so any sort of 3D structure of panels coming out of your square of paper. And the way it's proved is very simple. You just, every vertex of this picture is either degree 0, 1, 2, or 3, or 4. And for each one, there's a pattern. This is what a degree 4 vertex looks like. For degree 2, you know, there's two different types. This is what a turn looks like. I don't have a straight here. For degree 1, this is what it looks like. You just see that pattern replicated. And so you can build up a vocabulary, and then when you have a picture like this, you can figure out that it actually spells amaze, because it's amazing. Bad pun. All right. So this is embodying the general spirit of this crazy idea of puzzle fonts. What if reading the text in your font actually was a puzzle? So there's some hidden message. What can you put in there? And I wanted to show you one more example of such a puzzle font. This is another message, which I'm guessing you can't read because I haven't even told you what puzzle you're trying to solve. But it sort of uniquely encodes some text. And it's based around this open problem, which has been around for a while. A lot of people in the computational geometry world have worked on it, especially those in Spain. So you have a bunch of disks. Think of these as turning gears or motors. And you have a conveyor belt, and you want to wrap that conveyor belt around the gears so that it's taut everywhere. There's no slack, and the conveyor belt doesn't cross itself anywhere. So this would be, if you really wanted to build a conveyor belt, then now there's a way to turn each of these gears simultaneously and just sort of pull on the conveyor belt, and it would move nicely. So it turns out this is not always possible. This is a configuration with some really big disks and some really tiny disks that you cannot do such a thing. But the big open question is, if all of the disks have equal radii, can you always do it? The conjecture is you can always do it. But it's very hard. No one's been able to prove it. And so we thought, oh, it would be fun to make a puzzle around this. And so we started designing letters. These are equal radius disks known as thumbtacks. And elastic bands, and this is, you know, just a fun evening playing around making different letters. And then the idea is you remove the red string and you get the puzzle font, and each one of them has a sort of unique solution. If you assume that the thing has to be a letter, then there's pretty much only one letter that each of these patterns can make, and so you use that to write your message. Like this one that I showed you before is convey via conveyor belts. And if you want to play with it, it's online, and you can write rigidity is cool, and give that to someone, and tell them the open problem, and they'll think for a long time and eventually figure out that's the solution. All right, so that's puzzle fonts. One thing I've been working on more recently, because I think it's kind of fun, there's a lot of different, especially crazy complicated games like Magic the Gathering. How many people have played Magic the Gathering? Okay, only a few. Trust me, it's one of the most complicated games in existence. That fair statement? Sure, why not? it's probably undecidable to play in general, but it's very hard to even state what the problem is mathematically because there's hidden information. It's sort of such an open arena. But there's this idea that takes all sorts of two-player games and more-player games and reduces them to a puzzle. And the puzzles are usually easy to think about. And these are mate-in-one puzzles. Can I win in one move? And so I think this is a fun theme, and we've been working on a lot of different games. I'll show you a few of them. This started out for me with checkers, which in general, for an n-by-n board, is known to be very, very hard. It requires exponential time to solve. The 8x8 board has been solved. That's just constant time, so that's easy. But it turns out if you just want to know, can I win in one move in a game of checkers, that can be solved in polynomial time. You may not be very impressed, but there are actually a lot of possible one moves when you have, because you can do many jumps. And so to prove this, you can, one way is, you know, all the pieces on the checkerboard stay on the black squares. So you can just erase the white squares, and you get this picture. And now the pieces move horizontally and vertically. And so now if you look at the jump pattern, if you're black, say, and you have a king, and you want to, say, jump over here, jump over here, jump over here, jump over here, maybe jump back there, that would kill all of these white tokens, but it would leave the others remaining. In general, when you jump, you stay in the same sort of parity class here. You're always jumping by two in this picture. And so, in fact, you can draw a graph of all, you stay in this sub-pattern, this black sub-pattern of different positions. And so you can draw a graph of in order to jump over this, this token is like an edge in the graph. And then what you're aiming to do in order to win the game and destroy all the white remaining pieces is an Euler tour of that graph, and that we can solve in polynomial time. This turns out to be rather old. We rediscovered it, but in 1978 this was observed. This is sort of the beginning of Meighton 1. But there are other games where even just deciding whether you can win in one move is very, very hard. So here is where we started with Philosopher's Football. This is a game by Conway, and it's played on a Go board. This is not an actual game of Philosopher's Football. This is a game of Go. But because in Philosopher's Football, there's only one black token. That's the ball. Okay, and this is like soccer in that sense of football. There are two types of moves. Either you can place a white stone anywhere if it's not occupied, or you can take your black ball and kick it, so to speak. It's not your black ball. It's the shared black ball of both players. And you can jump over any consecutive sequence of white tokens, and then they immediately disappear. And then you can do that arbitrarily many times. That's one move to do a bunch of jumps and destroy various white tokens. Okay, so when you play a white token, it might be useful for you, but it also might be useful for your opponent, and you have to think about this. And as far as I know, no one has ever beat Conway at this game. He's very good at it. But it turns out, deciding whether you can win in one move by one kick of the black ball is NP complete. So if somehow you ended up with this configuration as along the way, then deciding whether this ball, your goal, by the way, is to get to either the top or bottom extreme, depending which player you are. So if you want to get down here, you first have to decide, do I take this top track and jump over here, or do I take this bottom track and jump down there? So that's sort of the A decision, and then there's the B decision, and then the C decision. And then you're going to retraverse all of those things again, and each one you decide, well, should I try to go this way or this way or this way? And it turns out that this will, and then you come back around, this will be possible if and only if you can satisfy some three-set formula. So it's NP complete to decide whether you can get down to here in one move. Originally we did this because it's very hard to analyze football. Even though it's perfect information, there's all these, it's easy to get back to the configuration you've been to. It's very hard to control. Recently, there's been some advance in the general game is at least piece-based hard, but it's probably even harder than that. It's just very hard to prove things about. But Meighton 1 was kind of relatively easy to prove things about because everything's just right there. You don't have to think about the alternation of players. It's kind of easy. All right, let me tell you a little bit about Magic the Gathering. It's a card collection game, I guess, which turns some people off, but it's basically, there's a whole bunch of these cards. You have a bunch in your hand and in your deck, and each of them has arbitrary logical text written there, and that text interacts with other cards, and it gets very complicated very quickly. Especially every year they release a whole bunch of new cards, and then there's all these new interactions, and it's very popular, point, and very complicated. But it turns out the very simplest part of this game, which is called Battle, is NP complete. To decide whether you can survive a single attack round is NP complete. So I'll just give you a sketch of what that looks like. It's mostly for the Magic players. You have attackers. They all have an attack value of S, and they have this special property called trample, which I'll get to. Then that's one player. The other player has these blockers, which have defense value A1. Or this one has some defense value, this one has some other defense value. They all have different defense values. And what you need to do as the defender, in order to survive, is to assign some number of defender, some number of blockers for each attacker. And you want that the total value of defense is at least the value of attack. Otherwise, because of this trample property, it will kill you, the player, which is down here. And so to decide whether you can do that is a problem called three partition. And so you will die. Or you'll survive if and only if this problem has a yes answer. And so this problem is NP hard. All right, how many people played Settlers of Catan? Yeah, a little more. This is pretty popular in the geek world. It's also extremely popular board game. and you don't need to know the rules or anything, except for one rule, which is called longest road. And the longest road rule says that if you have the longest road, so that you're building roads on this hexagonal grid, if you have the longest continuous path, then you get 2 points. And if you have 10 points, I think, you win. It turns out, even just deciding whether you have already won the game is NP complete. This is called mate in zero. So I give you a setup, I have a whole bunch of roads, other players have different roads. You just actually need to look at your roads. You have to look at all the players' roads, compute their longest, and see who has the overall maximum. If so, you might have 2 points, and if you have 8 points otherwise, you would win the game. This is, of course, in a generalized board that's very large, but it's basically a problem of finding the longest path or finding a Hamiltonian path in hexagonal grid graphs. And conveniently for us, this was proved NP hard a few years ago. So it's a fun sort of reductionist way to look at complicated games with die rolls, and all this game has die rolls, and so it's very messy to analyze mathematically, but you can do it by just looking at the mate in one or mate in zero problem. Cribbage, one more. Here, at the end of a cribbage you want to compute the score of your hand. And in cribbage, every subset of cards that sum to 15, you get a point, or some constant number of points. I forget the exact rules. And so that's a subset sum problem, essentially. There could be exponentially, if you generalize 15 to be any value k, then there can be your score can be exponential in the size of your hand. But using standard techniques, you can compute that value in polynomial time. So here, mate in one, or score computation is polynomial. Give you some variety. All right. I wanted to talk a little bit about, not most of this talk is about puzzles, but I wanted to tell you a little bit about this general picture, which I showed on Wednesday, which also has two-player games and team games. And it distinguishes two types of puzzles and games, which are those that take a polynomial number of moves, bounded games, and those that can take an exponential number of moves. And so, for example, Minesweeper and Tetris, these have bounded number of moves. You know, you do each thing once, and then it's sort of over. And so the natural complexity class this turns out to fall into is NP. These puzzles are definitely in NP. The question is, are they NP complete? And they turn out to be. Whereas sliding block puzzles, so here you have rectangles and you want to move them around and eventually get one piece to slide out the bottom slot, or rush hour puzzles you may have played with, these can take exponentially many moves. You might have to move the same piece many, many times. And so their natural class is piece-based, and it turns out those games are also piece-based complete. In the two-player genre, things go up by a class, so from NP you get piece-based, from piece-based you go to X time, and so chess and Go are known to be exponential time complete, so they're in some sense equivalent to each other, although players will tell you otherwise. So I think that's all I want to say about this picture. And then there's this book, Games, Puzzles, and Computation, that tries to unify all these different types of games into one framework, which I'm not going to describe in detail, but tell you a little bit about it. You have a directed graph, and you have blue edges and red edges. Blue edges count as 2, and red edges count as 1. And the rule is, at all times, at a vertex, you must have at least 2 units pointing in. So that's the constraint. And you're allowed to reverse edges, subject to that constraint. And it turns out, and if you're maybe you're one player deciding how to do this, and it's bounded and that each edge can only be reversed a constant number of times, or if it's unbounded, you have this kind of game, or you have 2 players, there's white edges and black edges, you can only flip your color of edges. That gives you these kinds of games. And the idea is you can model all these games with one kind of unifying super game. And that's the book, just translated into Japanese. But I wanted to show you this in the setting of sliding block puzzles. This is our original motivation. I've described them to you. They go back to the early 20th century. And here's what it looks like to prove that this puzzle is piece-based complete. So you have to build 2 gadgets, a kind of AND gate and a kind of OR gate. So here's a bunch of blocks, and imagine that the gray blocks cannot be moved because they're wedged against other blocks. So you have to prove that. But the idea is if you want to move this block down, you need to first move this block to the left, and you need to move this block down by one. If you move it down by one and this left by one, this can move left and down, then this can move down by one. So this is that, and that will only be possible if both of these move, that's the AND. The OR says I can move this guy down exactly when this guy moves left or this guy moves right. So like if this one goes left, then this can go down, this can go left, and this guy can go down. And that's it. What our book shows is that if you have an AND and an OR gadget like this and you can compose them arbitrarily, then you get your problem is piece space complete. And so that's the nice thing about this framework. Difference between light gray and dark gray. Yeah, light gray is the boundary. Yeah, that's probably all that it is. I forget. There's some more significant reason. It might have to do with how it's proved that they're immobilized. The boundaries argued a little bit differently than the interior. I think these were generated by a program, and the program, anyway, it's not a big difference. But you'll see it preserved throughout the figures, although they reverse. There you go. So this one, we had to write a program to check that it was indeed correct. But here we're thinking about, so this had 1x2 blocks and 1x3 blocks. What if you just have 1x2 blocks? Turns out that's also piece space complete. It just takes a lot more effort to build an AND gate and an OR gate. But once you do that, you're done. You can also use this to prove that rush hour is piece space complete. This was known before our work, but these are rush hour cars now. They can only move in one direction, and still you can build an AND gate and an OR gate. A slightly weaker version of an OR, but I won't go into that. So if you want to know more, you can check out our book. But here's a nice open problem. This does not seem amenable to this kind of analysis. What if you have rush hour, but all of the cars are unit squares? So I've drawn them not quite as unit squares here, but this car can only move up and down. This car can only move left or right, and you want to move this car out of this position. It turns out in this 5x5, you need 199 moves to move that car out. That's the hardest 5x5 puzzle. And this one, you need 732 moves. It's the hardest 6x6 puzzle. Looks like it's growing exponentially, but we don't even have an example of a puzzle that requires an exponential number of moves to solve. So I've worked on this several times. It seems very difficult to prove either way. All right. But on the topic of sliding blocks, I wanted to talk about another recent result on interlocked polygons. So suppose I have some polygons, like these two. I call them interlocked because you can't rigidly move one in the plane without colliding with the other. Because these guys are not interlocked, I can slide them apart. So if I give you a whole bunch of polygons, how do you decide whether they're together interlocked, that either they fly apart or some of them stick next to each other? For two polygons, you can solve that in polynomial time, but for lots of polygons, it's piece-space complete. And you can prove that using what we just talked about, which was sliding blocks are piece-space complete. So normally with sliding block puzzles, you have a big rectangular box around the outside, and you're not allowed to penetrate the box. But if you turn that box into a bunch of sliding blocks of these weird shapes, then this thing will essentially stay interlocked. There's sort of the whole thing is together locked. Unless this piece can move over one, which is sort of what you're trying to decide from the sliding block puzzle, if that can move over one, then this guy can move up, and then this guy can move left, and then that can move down out to infinity, and then this can move out to infinity, and then this guy can move left, and then up to infinity. And then the whole thing flies apart because your box is gone. So that's a quick proof that this is just as hard as before. So to make the problem simpler, let's think about deleting pieces. So for example, these blocks are interlocked, but if I remove any one of them, they fall apart. And these are interlocked, but if I remove any two of them, they fall apart. And these are interlocked, but if I remove any three of them, they fall apart. This is like the rope tying magic I was doing on Wednesday. Can you design a set of polygons so that whatever for some subset of the pieces get removed, then the whole thing falls apart. And so you can say, well, this is the function of, did I remove at least one piece, did I remove at least two pieces, and so on. What functions can you build? And it turns out any monotone Boolean function can be built. So you have to have the property, if you remove more things, it's going to fall apart more. That's a monotone, and it's Boolean, just it either falls apart or it doesn't. So, and the proof looks something like this. I have a little program to illustrate it. So we're cheating a little bit in that we only let you remove one of these pieces. These are the special variable pieces. So maybe I remove this one, which lets me move this guy left, and stuff happens in here. And then if eventually I can move this piece left, then I can move this down and out to infinity. I can move this up and over to infinity. I can move this up and over to infinity. This guy goes out, and then this goes out to infinity, and game over. Everything flies apart. And then you just have fun and build different gadgets, like, well, if this guy had moved left, then nothing happens. But if they both move left, then this guy can move left, and then that's an AND gate over here. And this is a split. As soon as this moves left, both of these can move left. And there's an OR gate. If this guy moves up, then this can happen, which triggers this part over here. The same would have happened if I had moved this down, then that would have happened. And it's a turn gadget. Anyway, you get, here's an actual example of a construction. So maybe I remove, I don't know, this one. Actually, why don't I ask you? You want to do variable 1, 2, or 3? 1. Okay. So that triggers this split, which triggers this to fall over and go up. And this goes, and we get stuck here, but this is still going. We're stuck. Okay, you want to remove variable 2 or 3? 3. Okay. It's fun being a computer. Let's see. That's a crossover gadget. Okay, now we trigger things and we go off to infinity. Cool. So the blocks fell apart only when I removed block 1 and 3. And in fact, 3 would have been enough by itself. This is actually a formula for x1 and x2 or x3. But you can build any formula of ands and ors. And that's what monotone Boolean formulas are. And so this is kind of a fun puzzle design question. Yeah. I'll tell you a little bit about it while we're taking things apart. Jigsaw puzzles, these are very old, from the 1700s. Used to be made by jigsaws, hence their name. But these days, they're made by die cutters. If I give you a bunch of pieces, figuring out whether you can assemble them into, let's even ignore what pattern is on there, just can I assemble them into a rectangle or a square or something. Related to this intuitively are edge matching puzzles. You've probably seen something like this. These are called signed edge matching puzzles. You have these triangles and they have half of a frog. You've got to match them up along the edges. And this is a valid solution, it looks like. When can you do that? And also intuitively related are these so-called polyform packing puzzles. The most famous is the Eternity puzzle, because the first person to solve it got £1,000,000. I don't know how they convinced the insurance company to do that, but they did. And then a few months later, it was solved. And this is there's actually many solutions, turns out. But they got their £1,000,000, and the company went bankrupt. But they made an Eternity 2 puzzle, which is actually an edge-matching puzzle, and that is, I think, is still unsolved. Anyway, it turns out not only are these puzzles intuitively related, but they are formally related in that if I give you a jigsaw puzzle with n pieces, I can make an edge-matching puzzle with order n pieces that has the same set of solutions, and I can convert an edge-matching puzzle into a polyform packing puzzle. I can go all the way around the cycle and only lose a constant factor in the number of pieces. And furthermore, they're all NP-complete. That's maybe less surprising, but wasn't known before. So that's kind of fun. A little stronger than NP-completeness is that they're all sort of constant factor equivalent. Let me skip some. Well, I don't know. Maybe people care about disk packing. This is either a puzzle. It also has some origami applications. I give you a bunch of disks. Do they fit in a box? It turns out that people have known disc packing is hard intuitively for a long time, but we've proved that packing a given set of discs into a given square is NP-complete. FYI. Let's see. I want to... running out of time, so let me skip some stuff. This is kind of a fun puzzle. The little... Let me jump to dots and boxes. That would be the last topic. There's some nice open problems here, too. You've probably played this game. It's kind of slow in the beginning, but in each move you draw a line segment in a grid of dots. And if you ever complete a square, you get a point. And you go again. That extra move from completing a square is very important. For example, let's say you're green and you play here, and then blue takes this square and gets another move, so it also gets to take this square and gets another move. Here, getting another move is not such a good thing, because if no matter where blue goes, he opens up a chain of squares. So maybe blue goes there. Now green can take that square, take that square, take that square, take that square. This is one move. Take that square. And now normally, if you're a kid, you would take these two squares, and then you'd have to open this one, and then blue would take all of these, and then it would be a tie. But in fact, green can win from this position. Any suggestions how? The upper right, yeah. So if you play here and don't take these squares, blue essentially has... Then blue has to take those squares, and then blue has to open this chain, and then green gets all of these. So you get two-thirds of the, or three-quarters of the board instead of half. So not a lot is known about this game. It's at least NP-hard. Made in one is polynomial time. it's probably piece-based complete. But to simplify the game, what about sort of 1 by N? This is sort of the simplest thing you can imagine. It's only one square tall. Who wins? This is an open problem. It's kind of crazy that this is open. We almost thought we'd solved it at some point with this group here, but proof doesn't work. The conjecture would be for odd n, it's a second player one. For even n, it's a draw. And we've verified that exhaustively up to 11, but it seems very hard to prove anything. So that's a nice open problem if you want something to work on. There's a variation of dots and boxes called Swedish dots and boxes, where the outer boundary is taken at the beginning. This is a very easy game to win. First player wins, it just takes all the boxes. Okay, so why am I talking about Swedish? Swedish is interesting for larger boards, but 1 by N, it's a little trivial. hey, we have a theorem. Well, there's this other kind of game called Misere games, where your goal is to lose. So it's like you're playing with your kids and you want them to feel good about themselves. So you want to get as few points as possible. How do you minimize your score? Well, now, for 1 by N, it's in some ways it's easier, I would say. This is not usually the case. Does anyone want to play this game with me? I could even let you go first if you want a chance at winning. The far left vertically?
Yeah.
Okay, you go here. Okay, I'm gonna... Wow. This is hard. I'm not used to the second player because I can't win. let's see. Maybe I'll go here. Well, actually, sorry. It would be more illustrative if I went first. Because then I know what to do. So, where would you like to go? Just kidding. Actually, that's not a winning move. I think this is a winning move. You can get some points. Your goal would be to your goal is to get the least points. That's right. Mirror. Okay, good. Then I'll go, I don't know, here. You want to keep mirroring? All right, this is going to be fast. Let's see. Now I should go. I don't know whose turn is it. My turn, right? Okay. Let's see. I guess I'll go. Well, we'll just keep finishing it off. Okay. Now it's my turn, and I open the box. You have to take one. Oh, right. Sorry. You don't take one. So you open another box, I open a box, you open a box, I open a box, you open a box, I open a box, you take all the boxes. Okay? In general, there's a strategy, which was pretty easy to follow in this case, but it's essentially a parity argument, or parity situation. If you succeed in reversing the parity on me, then I'm in trouble by taking a box early. It actually is good for you to take a box sometime during that game because you could potentially flip whose move it is. But I basically force you to not take any boxes by this little strategy. In order to do so, I might have to take boxes myself, but only a third of them, so I'll still win if the threshold is a half. Let me end, I think, with this open problem. Should be so much easier. Swedish, Miser, 1/n dots and boxes. So here's the initial configuration. If you wanted to maximize your score, you take all the boxes. If you want to minimize your score, what's the answer? And the conjecture is that this is the answer. It's kind of messy. The minus is you lose. The plus is you, I forget which is losing and winning. I guess minus is you win and plus is you lose. And eventually it's you only lose or win by one or you tie. And then there's a star here to mean this is periodic at this point. So this is what we call an eventually periodic sequence. Some weird stuff at the beginning. So for example, for 1/7, it turns out the best strategy is to take one box and then go there, because then the blue player has to take all the boxes. Okay, and so the blue takes 6. We only took 1, so that's the 5 we lost by, we won by 5 there. That was good for us. And we verified this up to very large, and we have almost a proof. And you can read our paper if you want to know. This is a conjecture that would imply this theorem, or this conjecture. It's still a little tricky. Almost every move takes a box here, but still figuring out who wins is pretty tricky. So that's it. Thanks. Hope you enjoyed.